or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
And about a half hour from now, in the second half of the show, I've dug up some really specific information about who really is hiring today, specific companies, and dovetail that against the list of what are great places to work. So I'm going to share some pockets of opportunity, but also some amazing, frighteningly bad news about the long-term future of employment in this country, where jobs will and won't be. But first, you can't be an effective change agent. You can't change people just with your words. You need to be able to read nonverbals. And reading those nonverbals can be a really good weapon you can acquire, and you will acquire, this morning on Work with Marty Nemko. My guest is Joe Navarro. He was a career FBI agent specializing in nonverbal communications, and he's now a consultant to major companies and talks. He's been on Hardball with Chris Matthews, Today Show, CBS Early Show, CNN, and so on. He is the author of What Everybody is Saying and another book called Louder Than Words. Subtitle, I hate the hypey subtitles, but what the heck. Take your career from average to exceptional with the hidden power of nonverbal intelligence. With that little snarky comment, I hope you won't hang up on me. Joe Navarro, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hey, Marty, it's good to be back. And yes, you named all those shows, but especially your show.
Well, you're very kind. It's been a while. I've been in about 10 years, I would say, something like that.
Not quite, but it's good to be back, and you've got a great audience out there.
I do. So, what things are nonverbal cues that most people don't think about?
It's a great question. You know, really anything that communicates a message or is symbolic is a nonverbal. So here's something that most people don't think about: how we use time, how quickly we react. Something like the weight of the paper of a resume affects how that resume is perceived. 24-pound paper is perceived as having more merit than, let's say, 20-pound paper. Mm. So here's something, how things feel is a nonverbal.
Very interesting. You mentioned time. It is true. The latency between when the previous person finishes talking and when you talk is a tremendous indicator of the amount of thought you're giving to what he said. It's a sign of respect if you take a little time, but if you take too long, you seem dumb. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, it's a very cultural thing. There are cultures where you're supposed to think about what the other person said instead of, jumping right in and as sometimes happens here in the States, we step on their thoughts. But it's not just that. It's also, for instance, how quickly we react to things. For instance, when somebody shows up at your door, do you wait so that then they walk over to you, or do you immediately rise and walk over to them? That simple behavior, that rise to action, makes that person at the door feel special when you come and greet them versus, you know, them having to work their way to you. And so when you look at banks that are all up against the same prime lending rate, just having the manager come out and meet new people makes people feel special when they walk into that bank.
That's so interesting. That reminds me of once I was visiting at a college, and the president, instead of having the secretary usher me in, he came out, and not only did he come out to get me, he then poured, he had all kinds of a phalanx of assistants. He poured the coffee for me out of a silver tea set by himself. There was something that was very, messages that gave me that he was giving me respect and that he was not so elitist. You're right.
Well, and that's what's interesting is here you're remembering this from years ago, mm-hmm. and you'll tell a lot of people about it. And what's interesting is that positive things we tell a lot of people about, but negative things we tend to retain far longer. And so, you know, for businesses, this is a great way to differentiate yourself, is this movement to action, you know, act proactively, be pro-social, move quickly, and get all of your staff on board of this and say, we cannot afford to waste any time, because time is a nonverbal that has value.
Interesting point. So let's turn this, let's apply this to the job interview, since this show focuses so much on work. So there is a dilemma that when somebody is, you're waiting in the waiting room to meet meet one or more interviewees, do you, if you're called in by the, typically the assistant will call you into the office, do you go up to his desk? Do you wait to, what would you be the, if you were going for a job interview and you were sitting in the waiting room, and the receptionist said, okay, please come in. She opens the door. What would Joe Navarro do to maximize the positive impression he would make on the interviewers?
Two things you can do immediately. Immediately rise and move towards where you're being directed. But as you're moving, or as you recognize the person that just came out, and this is something that we do with people on trial to impress juries, is fix your jacket, pull down, you know, preen yourself a little bit. We are very sensitive to this. And when people preen themselves around us, it shows us that they care how they appear. So just by how quickly we move and how we take care of ourselves says, oh, this person cares about himself, and he cares about us, because he is, you know, not being slow or delayed in any way. It's a very subtle thing, but when we show students videos of someone doing this, invariably, you know, upwards of 65%, without knowing, they rate the person that does this as a better candidate, and the interview hasn't even begun yet.
Amazing. So preening, that's a great one. I never would have thought of in a million years. Maybe that's coming up.
In the courtroom, what you do is when the jury comes in, you rise if you're the defendant, and the attorneys, we all preen yourself. It's a powerful behavior.
Doesn't that make you seem nervous? You know, you always see on TV when the guy is kind of straightening his tie or whatever, it's almost like that's a tell that he's nervous. Am I wrong?
Well, actually, you're very accurate. I would avoid the neck touching, because neck touching is usually associated with some sort of issue or discomfort. But certainly pulling on your jacket, straightening your shirt and that sort of thing. The reason we know it's a powerful behavior is because we use it in courtship behavior. When we're dating, we do a lot more of that, and it demonstrates to the other person that we actually care about them.
So let's mine this further. So now you've walked in, you've preened yourself, you've straightened out your jacket. What's the next thing you do? Do you go to the person's desk, to the interviewer's desk? Do you wait? What do you do? Everything you would do non-verbally to maximize your good impression?
Well, the next thing I would do is, you know, obviously you're listening for instructions. Do they just guide you into the room? If they just welcome you into the room, you don't sit. You stand and you wait for directions. The other thing that you don't do is you don't violate their space. I've seen a lot of people that, you know, they're so nervous that they just sort of, they come in and then they're standing very close to the person they're meeting. And right off the bat, they're making things uncomfortable. Hopefully they'll direct you to sit down, and then when you sit down, you accommodate yourself, and then now your total focus is on the person in front of you. You don't look around, you don't meander, your eyes don't wander, because you don't have the right and the privilege to do that. Only the interviewer has the right and the privilege to do that.
If you had written in the book, as I was reading the book before the show, you said the handshake is an issue. I mean, we all know you're supposed to give a firm handshake. How, and I imagine it varies with the culture, but, you know, stuff about smiling, you talked about taking a step back, a slight angle, you know, all that stuff. Give me that. What's the you know, there's never a universal, but what is the common American best practice regarding all that stuff?
Well, you know, we have so many cultures in America. You know, in New York, There's a lot more touching that goes on with the hand. In the Midwest, there's less of that. What I tell people is, as you go to shake hands, you're obviously smiling and so forth. But this is the first time two humans touch, so get it right. You know, don't be too aggressive, because no one likes a very aggressive handshake. Mm-hmm. Don't play hand jujitsu, as some books recommended in the 1980s. That's just nonsense.
Hand jujitsu, what's that? What's that mean?
Oh, that's when there was a book that came out that suggested that you should turn your hand in this way and that way so that your hand is always on top, so that you're superior. So all that ends up doing is pissing people off, and it just leaves a bad reputation. The other thing is, you don't want to give too weak of a handshake. We've all shaken hands with someone and we said, oh, that's, you know, we didn't like that. But the fact of the matter is that there's many cultures that have very weak handshakes, and that we mustn't think anything of it. And so I just say, mirror the handshake of the more senior person, and just roll with it, because, you know, that's where they're comfortable. And interviewing is really about comfort. It's about psychological comfort, so that you're thinking clearly, so that they're perceiving you as someone that they should bring on board. And the only way that we can show confidence is when we're comfortable. It's when we're uncomfortable that we show these stray little symbols and signs of lack of confidence.
Yeah, one of the ways you can make somebody feel comfortable is a word you just used, mirror. How important is that? I heard that first many years ago with neuro-linguistic programming. How critical is it that you mirror the amount of smiling, the pace of speech, the degree of intellectuality, the body language, mirroring all that? How critical is that, do you know?
Oh, it's very critical. And actually, mirroring goes back to Carl Rogers in 1962, which predates NLP by about 17 or 18 years. And what Carl Rogers found was that when we reflect the feelings and the sentiments, and specifically the words, if you're interviewing me and you refer to the corporation, and I come in and I say the business, we're not communicating empathetically. So it's key to listen to those specific words and to deliver them back, as is the body language. If the person that's interviewing you is sitting very formally and behind a desk, and you know, there, you can tell that this is a very formal person, don't sway out on the chair, don't over relax and so forth, because this isn't going to sit well.
You know, you and I are getting a little older. You know, there, and I know when we were young, when you would certainly come in for an interview, you would say, you would call somebody by, you know, Mr. Jones. Today, yep. It seems like there's been a great transition to calling them Bob. Do you have an opinion about that in the job interview situation, or do you not really know?
No, absolutely. In fact, I still tell students, ask what this person or that person would like to be known as. You know, how may I address you? That shows respect. You know, keep in mind, Marty, that all manners are nonverbal. And when you display good manners, you're communicating that you're sensitive to, social comportment and so forth. When all things are equal, who do we want working for?
Yep.
We want people that are confident, yes, but we also want them to be socially responsible. We want them to be well-mannered.
You know, you may think this is good manners, but Joe, you're a great guest. You are filled with non-obvious, valuable content stated concisely. I'm talking with Joe Navarro. He is the author of What Everybody Is Saying. We're talking about nonverbals, especially as it applies to career issues. Smile is such a big issue. Yep. You know, what's there? A fake smile. We've all seen the car salesman fake smile. How does one, you know, by definition, if you're kind of trying to smile, it is fake intrinsically. Do you favor or oppose the idea of consciously trying to smile more? And if you do advocate it, how would you suggest people make it not look fake?
Well, and this is where great actors become exceptional actors, and it's that they can muster the will to give you that smile. You know, I think there are 10 situations where, twelve people enter an elevator all at once and they all give each other that fake smile. Don't even try to go for an accurate smile here. You're actually doing the best that you can. And I think you should try to smile as best you can. But there are times when there's tension. And one of the things that I teach is always front what's bothering you. So, you know, if you just had contact lenses put in and your blink rate is high, we often associate high blink rate with deception or stress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, make sure that the person understands, hey, I just got new contact lenses and that's why I'm blinking. If you're nervous, tell them that you're nervous because this helps to even the plane. And we expect people to be, there is no expectation that anyone come to an interview and not be nervous. This is nonsense. Everybody anticipates it. So just front it and say, I got to tell you, I'm a little nervous. There, it's out. Now we can go on.
I want to push back about that a little bit. Yep. I need to give a little bit of an anecdote. My mom is old, and we Skype every other day. She's back east, and I'm here in California, obviously. And so on Skype, you can see both her on one screen and you see yourself on another.
Mm-hmm.
And my normal demeanor, I'm not a depressive, but I'm not a happy-go-lucky guy. I'm on the, if five is neutral, I'm a four. and so when I look at myself on that Skype video when I'm talking with her, I'm really very sad. I'm more than a four, lower than a four, because I'm seeing my mom old. I'm seeing her decline. So I'm really a two or a three. But if I let my face look the way it does when I'm a two or a three, it's going to bring her down and make me depressed. Yeah. So because I can see myself, I put on a big smile. I've learned a trick, which is you want to smile so that you actually, the smile lines around your eyes crease. If you're just doing it with your lips, it looks funny. With your mouth, it looks phony. I look much better. So that if I were going in a job interview, I wouldn't just say, oh, I'm nervous. I would be, honestly, I would smile a lot. I would use my big natural smile where my eyes were, you know, not constantly, because I don't want to look like I'm psychotic, but I would fake, try to create a as good an actor's smile with my smile lines creasing as possible. Would you oppose that?
No, not at all. In fact, if you can muster it, I would do it. You know, that's called the Duchenne smile. That involves the corner of the eyes, and it involves a full relaxed face. But I have to tell you, because every interview I've done, and I did over 10,000 interviews in the bureau, everybody was always nervous and tense. And so you would see that smile at first, and then that, you know, the sort of the fakiness would crack through. But if you can do it, then do it. And obviously, how many times have we heard party face, party smile, and we rise to the occasion. So if you can do it, obviously, because it puts people at ease. And I'll tell you something else that puts people at ease is just tilting your head slightly. It relaxes the neck muscles, it relaxes the facial muscles. We usually only unveil our neck when we're around people we really like. And so if during an interview you can just tilt your head just ever so slightly, it makes you look more receptive. It makes you look at someone more empathetic.
And I definitely have to push back on this one, Joe, but you can push back on me. You know, one of the things that I've noticed, I read once that Barack Obama was taught a technique by one of his coaches that he should always tilt his chin slightly up, not down, because it makes him look much more confident. Not too much where he looks like he's stuck up, but he tilts it up a little bit. And in a job interview or even in any work situation, in any meeting, you want to appear confident. We are a very shallow people. We make judgments based on crap like that. Isn't it wiser to really tilt your neck slightly up?
Well, the one thing is the chin. A chin display is that is neutral or slightly up. What I'm talking about is the neck tilt, which babies at 4 weeks recognize and makes us appear more sympathetic.
Oh, you mean to the left? You mean left or tilting it to the left or right?
Yeah, to the
left. Oh, I thought I forward. I see. Okay.
Yeah. No, it exposes our necks, which demonstrates that we're comfortable. I was just asked this question yesterday over the internet. Somebody said, what's the quickest way to show that we are confident? And I said, the quickest way is, number one, know your material. But number two, find somebody who has great nonverbals, who is very confident, and mirror those behaviors.
That's
really the easiest way. Just find that person out there, and it doesn't matter whether it's a politician or a military person, but look at those behaviors and say, you know what, I like that, and then use those when you go to do that interview.
Actually, your book talks about a lot of, you know, fairly generic ways to appear more confident, to lean slightly forward, to nod,
exactly,
to open body language, and steepling your hands, where you kind of put your fingertips together in like a steeple. How should that be consciously used, or does that look manipulative? What are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, some people are very comfortable doing that. Others rarely do it. And what I say is, if there's one important point you have to make, save that steeple where you put your fingertips together for that specific point, so that it becomes more significant. Steepling is one of those behaviors that says, I'm confident. It's one of those behaviors, and this is fascinating, that children who are born blind and have never seen this behavior actually perform it while talking to other blind children. So we know it's hardwired in our brains to both perform it and to look for it, and it shows that we're confident.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Joe Navarro. He was a career FBI agent specializing in nonverbal communication. He's interviewed 10,000 people, and he has written a number of books, including What Everybody is Saying. Speaking of bodies, Helen Gurley Brown, who is the founder of Cosmo, she says, she's only half joking. She said, after 40, it all comes down to posture. Any non-obvious advice around posture?
Well, no, I think she's exactly right. I also like what Lincoln said, that after 40, we have the faces we deserve.
Right.
Our posture says a lot about our health. It says a lot about how we feel. For instance, I've had a lot of physicians tell me that the clinically depressed, you can tell from their posture that they're just downbeat, that they're,
yep,
you know, very down. So posture is important, how you carry yourself, how you come in, your physicality says a lot about you. And so you can't ignore it. And by the way, you know, I tell this to a lot of young people, don't let the first time you go to a job interview be the first time you wear that dress or that outfit or that suit. I've seen so many young men go for a job interview for the first time for that new suit.
Right.
They'd never worn it.
Right.
And they look like, you know, they look like they're Bozo the Clown working the
right
this clothing. Get used to the clothes so that you look confident in those clothes.
Yeah, actually what I tell people to do, you know, the days are over when you have to wear a suit for an interview. My rule for interviews is you want to dress one notch above how you would dress in the interview, in on the actual job. And if in doubt, you call the office and ask the admin, what is the normal dress code for people at my job title? I'm coming in for the interview, and come in one notch above that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I agree. And, you know, the attire has changed. But I also have to say, you can never go wrong with a suit. You can always say, well, I was somewhere else previously, or I was engaged doing something else. And the second thing is, you should dress for the job that you aspire to have.
Right, right. There is a cultural difference here. In California, if you walk into a Silicon Valley job as a programmer in a suit, they're going to you're dead. You know, it's okay. Yes, if a corporate lawyer for sure, but there's much more casual dress codes here.
I agree.
Okay, let's. I want to make another comment about posture. I have very bad posture by nature, and I really have to work at it. And one thing that somebody told me that made a lot of sense to me is posture. Everybody thinks about posture, and they're going to straighten their back, and they're going to straighten their head. but they don't think about their shoulders. They're showing your, unless your shoulders are back, you look, you do, you give that depressed look. So I make a point of having my shoulders not back in military style, because then it looks too much, but making sure that I am truly a la yoga, fully aligned, that my shoulders, my head, my back, everything is straight. Is that, you buy that advice?
Oh, no, I buy that completely. And that's why we admire dancers. When we look at professional dancers, because they do exactly what you're describing, and we look at their physique and we think it's magnificent. The only thing they're really doing differently is they are carrying themselves really as we should.
Now I want to turn. We've spent most of the time talking about kind of making a good impression yourself, but of course, especially in the FBI, but also in all of our interactions, whether we're talking with a coworker or our spouse, we are also looking to get a sense of how the other person is behaving, and are they comfortable or uncomfortable, and are they lying? So let's start with uncomfortability. I am in a meeting and I generally, sometimes I want to make somebody uncomfortable, but generally I want to make them comfortable. What are some tells that will help me know that maybe the other person is feeling uncomfortable?
Yeah, that's a great question. Oftentimes what you see is a little bit of distancing. The person will be leaning away. Perhaps they'll begin to touch their neck. There'll be lip compression. Maybe even some lip biting. These are, or ventilating behaviors, for instance, a lifting up on the clothing or the hair to ventilate. These are letting us know there's something at issue here. It's not about deception. It's about something's bothering me right now. And is it what's being said? Is it the general topic? Or is it the circumstances of the meeting? So you have to pay attention to those things.
Mm-hmm. You say that the most important part of the body to watch is not the head, because we all kind of realize people are looking at our face, and so we kind of put on the phony smile. You say the most important part of our body is the
feet.
Tell us why.
Because the feet have no social contract. Our faces have a social contract. If you smile at me, by social contract, I have to smile back. But if I don't like you and you walk into the room, I will look at you, but my feet will begin to distance me from you. And we must never ignore these behaviors, which are extremely accurate. And that's why, you know, at an ATM machine or at a money machine, your feet begin to move around when you sense people are too close, or it's late at night, or you see something suspicious.
So in a meeting, whether it be a job interview or a regular work meeting or whatever, what are the specific tells in one's feet, other than that maybe the two or three that we should most be alert to?
Well, I would look for the person who all of a sudden, when you ask them a question, if they suddenly, and I've seen this in a lot of interviews, all of a sudden they interlock their ankles around the legs of the chair. That's often a self-restraining behavior, and if it's because of the question you ask, there's some issue there. And it's not just the feet; it's the legs too. Oftentimes, you'll ask a person a question, for instance. You know, have you had problems with alcohol or drugs, or you say, you know, our company requires you to take a drug test, and the minute you say that, the person begins to rub their hands on their foreleg. Something's bothering them. This is a pacifying behavior. It's extremely accurate, and it says this person didn't like that question. Now, it doesn't mean that they're a drug addict or they're an alcoholic. They may just not like the fact that, you know, this job is so intrusive, but it's an issue, and they just identified it for you.
Okay. Let's turn to the lying question.
Yeah.
Are there particularly reliable tells specifically that there's no proof, but, you know, the presence of one or two of them especially would be a pretty darn good indicator that the person is dissembling?
Well, let's clear the air. Number one, there is no Pinocchio effect. There is no single behavior indicative of deception.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what do we see? You ask the question, have you ever been fired for committing a theft or something like that? and you see displays of discomfort. You see the clenching of the jaw. You see the pacifying behaviors of touching of the face, maybe covering of the neck, this type of thing. The only thing that tells us is this is something that bothers me.
And so we're back to the uncomfortability thing, right?
So we're back to discomfort, but no one, there is not one behavior that says, you know, I mean, I remember reading years ago that if a person touches his mouth or touches his nose, they're lying. That's just absolute tripe.
Okay.
There's no science behind it, and the innocent as well as the guilty do it.
Yep. How important, the thing, one of the things you wrote in the book that I had heard again and again was the notion of catching, and this is what they use in an actual lie, you know, polygraph test, lie detector test, which is changes from baseline. So you're having a starting conversation and you're talking about whatever, and he's, you know, has a certain amount of leg movement or a certain amount of smiling or a certain amount of whatever. And then you start to ask harder questions and all of a sudden you see a dramatic change. How important is that notion of change from baseline?
Well, this is critical. And of course, when you live with someone, they're used to your baseline. Your mother was used to your baseline, Marty. But the minute you begin to prevaricate and change your story or hide something, your mother detected or sensed an issue. You need the baselines. And that's why usually the first half hour of my interviews I spent calming the person down, talking about where they went to school and their family and so forth, because I want to get as close to normal as possible, so that then when I say, "Where were you last night?" and all of a sudden, you know, you see these indicators of discomfort and stress and so forth, then I say, "Oh, now I can identify this as being significant from everything else."
I'd like to end on a positive note.
Yeah.
You know, every one of us wants to be loved or at least liked and certainly respected.
Yeah.
Are there some common tells in the work situation? I'm talking about in the personal situation,
yeah,
you know, where you're going to run up and give you a big kiss. Are there in the business situation, in the work situation, ways to assess non-verbally whether to the extent to which a person likes you?
Oh, absolutely. For instance, when you walk through that door and somebody greets you and they arch their eyebrows and they flash their eyes, you know they like you. Why? Because that person is actually burning extra blood sugars for you, and that means they care. When we don't care about people, we just sort of, we don't defy gravity. We don't even raise our hands and greet you. When we're really happy and so forth, we do things that are demonstrative like that. We can look at pro-social things that people do. For instance, you're carrying a heavy box and one of your workmates says, "Hey, can I help you with that?" Those are little things that demonstrate that we care. Something that I worked with a guy for over a year, and not once did this person say good morning to me. And I just could not believe that two people could work in the same space and this person was just incapable of saying good morning to me until I saw him saying it to a supervisor, and then it dawned on me. He only cares about the people that can do something for him, not his equals or anyone below him.
Yeah, it's hard not to take it personally, though. There are a couple of people who do barely establish eye contact with me when they see me, and of course I think it's me, and who knows, maybe it is. Anyway, but one thing that's certainly sure is that you've been a great guest. Joe Navarro, thanks very much for being my guest again on Work with Marty Nemco. Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, good. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you.
I'm sorry. I thought you were cutting out. Marty, it's great to be with you. You ask great questions, and thank you for having me. You're the best.
Well, thank you. And, of course, his book is as good as he is on the radio. The book is right there. I mean, I consider a book the greatest bargain in the world, that for the cost of a pizza, you can have this guy, Joe Navarro, who's interviewed tens of thousands of people as a total pro at nonverbals, and you can have him by your side 24/7. The book that I would recommend among all the books that he's written is What Everybody Is Saying. Is that, by the way, is that the book that you would recommend? What's the one book that you would say people should buy if they want to really have Joe Navarro by their side 24/7?
I would say what everybody is saying. It's in 29 languages. It's the number one nonverbal book in the world right now, and it's easy to read, and it helps you to understand why we do the things we do.
I agree completely. It's an honor having you on the show, Joe. Be well.
Take care, Marty.
All right. Bye-bye. And now we turn to you, my dear listeners, as always. If you have a problem, it doesn't have to be in nonverbals at all, but any kind of work-related problem, from communication to a lack of skill set to a crisis of meaning in your life to not knowing what the heck you want to be when you grow up, to a self-employment idea you're not sure you'd pull the trigger and invest it, or whether you're already in the business and you think you should close up shop and looking for an idea to keep you afloat. Any kind of career-related, work-related idea, I can usually help at least give you a baby step, if not a giant step forward. I call them workovers, three-minute career makeovers is what I used to call them. In any event, for all of those reasons, the phone number to call, and this is the best time to call when the lines are available, it's 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Marty Nemco on KALW, 415-841-4134. And as I promised at the top of the show, I want to talk a little bit about where the jobs are and where they're not going to be. I always like to end with the positive, so I'm going to start with the negative here. I got this article from the World Futures Society that's titled, you're not going to like this one, 2 billion jobs to disappear by 2030. This is a guy who gave a speech at TED, and it was very popular. And here's an example of some of the ways in which those jobs are going to go away. As you well know, right now, your utilities, they have these huge power plants. PG&E has huge power plants, and then there's also these huge towers, all of which have to be maintained. Well, he says that already the utilities industry is working on having no more power plants. You would have an air conditioner-sized personalized home power plant, perhaps solar-powered, hydrogen-powered, I don't know, but that will be in everybody's house. So, yes, there will be some manufacturing jobs, unfortunately, probably in China. I don't know if it's really unfortunate, depending upon whether you're a world citizen or American citizen. But, you know, instead of, there is right now, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people whose job it is to go out and to work at these major plants, maintain them, install them, where if these are going to be more like appliances, they're going to be either basically more self-regulating. That's going to kill lots of utility jobs. I'll talk about some more later, but let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi. I'm a social worker. I work with young people who are having a difficult time moving on. Mm-hmm. A lot of them have been to college or dropped out of college, and I want to speak about one particular kid that I'm working with.
Sure.
He's in his mid-20s, and he is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And he has never never had a job. He just has a
Why?
Lot of...
Here is a guy who's in his mid-20s who's brilliant. Why has he never had a job?
Because he has... the reason I'm working with him is because he has ADD and has a really hard time. He's one of these people that's all in his head. He doesn't have, he can't register for classes. He can't, he has a hard time getting things done that most of us would find, really kind of the usual stuff that people...
Is there any application of his brilliance that you're aware of where he doesn't procrastinate, where he can get it done, or is he really can't get anything done because...
Oh, no, he gets things done that he is interested in, which is sort of the picture of ADD. He writes, he does a lot of political economy. He's very articulate. He's done blogs. He's done...
Okay, well, that's true of I'm interrupting you again, not to be rude, but because of the interest of time. Mm-hmm. People who are, I'm beginning to have real doubts about the whole quest, the term ADD. You know, I think... Because schools are so boring for so many kids who are active,
exactly.
They call them ADD. You take an adult who is not willing to, for example, let's say he feels that the consumerist culture in America is shallow and is not willing to play that game, or the corporate game, or the government game, or nonprofit game, whatever. And so That doesn't mean he's ADD. It means he's, I am not motivated to do that crap. But here we have this person. If it was really a physiological ADD problem, he wouldn't be able to write extensively as the way you say
Actually,
he does.
That's not true. If you're interested in something, you can concentrate. ADD isn't about not being able to concentrate. It's about not being able to concentrate on the things that bore you. But the thing about ADD is if you find your passion, you can concentrate for.
Right. Well, let's not worry about the labels. Let's try to help this kid.
I know, but what I'm saying is that if we could find the thing that he loves, then, you know, it would go a long way.
Got it.
But the problem is he hasn't gotten it, you know, he doesn't have any experience. So my concern is like, what would we put on a CV?
You wouldn't. A CV is, first of all, is a document that's used for PhDs.
Or a resume.
Well, nothing. A resume is going to make sure he doesn't get a job.
What do you do when you apply?
You don't apply, because once he applies for a job, that's openly advertised, there is going to be dozens of applicants, or if not more, and because he has no experience, he's never going to be the one selected. When an employer wants to hire somebody, and he's willing to go through the hassle of reviewing dozens or hundreds of ads, he or she is going to want to hire somebody with direct experience. So this is a guy who's got to try to sell himself based not on a resume, but based on the limited information you've given me, if he's a writer, he needs to send writing clips to everybody who potentially could value that kind of writing, whether it be magazines, whether it be certain websites, whether it be nonprofit organizations. Perhaps he could be a grant writer. But he is not going to get a job answering an ad, and he's not going to get a job with a resume. As I said, different people have different amounts of tolerance for work that is not intrinsically motivating. Some people, like myself, to be honest, I'm happy to do any productive work, and it doesn't have to be something I'm deeply passionate about. I love to be productive. But some people, and I don't want to call them ADD, some people are, let's just say, pickier. They will not stay motivated unless it's something they're interested in. If this guy is interested in political economy and he's interested in writing, he should have some samples of that writing, which he should send to every possible employer who's not advertising a job for whom that kind of writing would be impressive enough to make the employer hire them. And as I said, that could be a nonprofit. It could be government agencies. It could even be businesses that are trying to make us, you know, usually it would be, you know, I'm assuming when you're, you know, I guess because I've been in the Bay Area so long, when you hear the word political economy, I'm assuming it's from a liberal direction. Is that correct?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Well, if he's not, you know, there are, for example, there's the libertarian associations. You know, he should be sending his clips into the Independent Institute. It's here in Oakland. I think it's Independent Institute, something like that. And other think tanks. And he's not going to get hired as a scholar because he doesn't even have a bachelor's degree. But he could get a job in there doing some work. Whether they are maybe helping with the website, maybe whatever. But that is the best way that he is going to get a job. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've been encouraging him to do volunteer work to get in the door somewhere that way.
Maybe, and yes, and sometimes that works. But in this economy, too often employers are the percentage of volunteers who turn into full-time employees are very small. And given his lack of follow-through in most contexts, I fear that in a volunteer job, he's going to fail. He's not going to be the one out of 10 volunteers who's going to be great enough to get hired. I'd rather see him circumscribe his involvement with an employer in the area in which he's comfortable. And if he's most comfortable in writing and in writing in certain topics, I would rather see him submit clips that way and try to get paid rather than try to compete with a zillion of other volunteers. Does that make sense?
So you're talking about like magazines or organizations?
I'm talking about everybody. At nonprofits.
Almost like cold calls.
I am cold contacts. I am
in
his, because he's not going to do well on the phone. If he tends to be distractible, he's not going to be good on the phone.
No. I was trying to make an analogy. So it's cold contacts where you just send in a piece of your writing. And would you do like a cover letter or something?
Yes. I would have him send a brief cover letter that also, especially because he's trying to write, should be a brief cover letter that expresses his strengths and his weaknesses. If he tends to not follow through on certain kinds of tests, he should put that in his cover letter. He should mention his strengths, where he does best and where he does worst, because that way First of all, it'll immediately impress the employer that he's being credible, being honest, which is so rare in the job search game. And two, he will screen out the wrong employers, the employers who are likely to not want a guy like him, and screen in the right ones. That's my best advice. I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Oh, hi. Is it? It's me, I guess.
It is.
Oh, hi, Marty. I want to pick your brain for a minute about any ideas you could give me to promote a little children's book that I finally published. I just retired from teaching special ed in the public schools. Mm-hmm. And the book documents a environmental service learning project that I started here in San Francisco in 1990. So it's over 20 years. And it's in verse form. It's really well illustrated. It's a cute little book, and I have no idea how to really promote it and get a buzz going. I'm terrible with computers.
Here are some of the things I would do.
Okay.
I would try to get it branded, meaning first of all, I would try to get it published by a major publisher. These days, there's just so much getting published. If it's really as good as you say, there are many children's book agents, and I certainly would give that a shot first. Because right now, the major publishing companies serve what is called a curating function. Because there's so many books out there that if it's been published by Random House, there's at least some sense that it is of quality. And we tend to look for some signals from that the book is likely to be of quality. So I would try that first. If that didn't, and even if they do publish it, because publishers only, they don't do that much, I would try to get it co-branded. So it says it's an environmental book. So I would contact every environmental organization and see if I can get them to either say this is, a Nature Conservancy book or a Wildlife World Preservation Wildlife Fund book, so that you can have that brand associated with you. Because being a retired special ed teacher is not a brand that's going to necessarily inspire a lot of confidence. It's going to make too many readers think, oh, she's just another retiree who's looking for something to do.
Ooh.
So,
yeah,
so you've got to brand it very differently than that. Third,
Let me just stop you real quick. So you're saying to get them to do, I'm sorry, I'm so dumb about it. Get them to advocate for it. Get them to write something on it or something? What do you mean?
To brand it. On the cover, we could say this is a World Wildlife Federation approved book, or this is a Nature Conservancy selected title or something with their logo on it. You know, no guarantees, but it costs you nothing to do that. And once you've got that brand, your credibility is instantly raised enormously. The other thing is, as I did for my own most recent book, we live in a video age. And so, and again, those people who insist on, buying American are not going to be happy with me about this. But because we live in a video age, I decided to create a 60 to 90 second video that's got animations in it and stills and photos and music and all this other stuff. American companies wanted between $2,000 and $10,000 to create a 60 second to 90 second video. But I went on odesk.com, which has people who are available for hire all over the world, and I got an award-winning video maker for $400 to create it. So I would create one of those videos, put it up on YouTube, put it up on your website, that might, if it's really a great video, it can't be boring. We live, unfortunately, in a very glitzy America that looks for snarky, silly, funny, wild, whatever. So it just can't be, hi, I wrote this book because it was really important to save the environment. That's not going to work. It's got to be visual. It's got to be surprising. It's got to be fresh. And with that can, if you're lucky, use the term, get a buzz going. Those are my first off the top of my head ideas. Does any of that make sense for you?
It all makes sense. It's very good. Can I ask one last question?
Please do.
Because the people in San Francisco, the project is... that can be seen all over San Francisco because it's been around so long. The little posters that are up in cafes reminding people to take only the napkins they need. And the kids make the posters and bring them in. It's service learning. So that already has kind of a reputation. How do I sort of put it out there that I don't know how to say, a lot of people know about this project since it started so long ago. Do you know what I mean? So how do I have that be a selling point? Just say it.
Yeah, I'd probably on the front cover of the book on the bottom, you could say, whatever your name is, Jane Jones, creator of the take only the napkins you need concept or something on the bottom. Okay. I would have a little one-liner on the bottom. That's more credible than being a retired special ed teacher. That gives you an edge.
Can people hire you to do a couple of sessions of deeper consultation for this kind of stuff?
I do that all the time. You can go to my website, and first of all, I've written over 1,000 articles, and there's a lot that's free on
cool.
everything.
Thank
so
you.
Start with that. Let's go to martynemko.com, MartyNemko. Start with what's free, and if you're still stuck, there's information on the site how you can email me with the request for an appointment. And if I've got room in the schedule, I'll see you. If not, I'll refer you to an appropriate associate.
Thank you.
Okay, you take care.
Thanks.
All right. Before we go back to the phones, I was talking about jobs disappearing in 2030. The other one that's really fascinating to me, I'm not going to do them all because I want to get to the positives. Surface transportation, all the driver jobs are going to go away. We are already starting to have driverless vehicles. The first wave of them is going to be kind of luxury vehicles that will just simply allow individuals to kick back and listen to music, have a cup of coffee, whatever. But eventually, trucks and taxis and buses, those drivers are going to be gone. Because there's no problem. You know, we always hear about drunk driving under the influence, and of course the cost of workers is very expensive. So if we can have both a more reliable driverless, vehicle that is also never going to get be drunk at work or stoned on the job, that's going to take over, and that's going to cost zillions of jobs. Before I go back to the phones, I promised I was going to share some specific companies where the jobs are, where there are jobs. And this is a cross tabs, they use the technical term, between companies. There was Fortune magazine did a major survey of lots of companies and picked what they thought were the 100 companies that were best to work in, and then identified the 25 of those that were hiring the most people. And that's what I wanted to share with you. At the top of the list was Google, but all who they're hiring is, or main, that's not all, mainly who they're hiring is very, very top-level software engineers. They're hiring, I think they've got openings for 400 software engineers right now, but they don't want them just to be software engineers. They want them to be polymaths. Polymath is a person who is just like a world citizen who's smart about everything, not just, a narrow little computer geek. So that's Google. Google is probably one of the most selective companies in the world to hire. They get 2 million resumes a year, and they only hire 7,000 people out of those 2 million. Harvard is easier to get into as a student than to get hired at Google. Other examples of companies that were in the top 100 places to work, as well as were in significant growth mode. Boston Consulting Group, all those consulting firms, the Ernst & Young, PricewaterhouseCoopers, KPMG, they're all in hiring mode. But frankly, and again, I always try to be honest, this is, much as I am a person who's critical of degrees, they are, those firms really won't even look at you unless you have a degree from at least a UCLA level, quote, in terms of prestige. Not saying the education is good, because in many ways it stinks, but at the level of prestige of UCLA on up, certainly through Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard, etc. One more before I go to the phones, something that I'm sure Bay Area people would be happy about. Whole Foods is continuing to be in growth mode. It says, quote, there are positions in stores at every level, and they encourage people to start at the store level and then move up. And that may be just PR to try to get people to serve in the deli, but that's what they say. And they also say, and this is maybe impressive to many, I know many people who listen to this show are liberal arts people. They don't have technical skills. Whole Foods says, we hire for attitude and train for skills. So if you are one of these chipper, upbeat type people who, in the face of a day in and day out checking people out at the check stand or whatever, and still chipper and smiley and customer service oriented, even if you don't have a lot of hard skills, it may be that Whole Foods, especially if you've got Bay Area sensibilities, might be a place that you might want to work. And now, let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It's your turn on the air. How can I help?
Hi, my name's Greg.
Hi, Greg.
I'm a consultant in fundraising, mm-hmm. Career in fundraising for 30 years, a consultant the last 5 years, specializing in an area called legacy giving or plan giving.
Right.
Mostly Bay Area clients, have had 30 of them, 11 current. Two are out of the area, one in Reno and one in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Minnesota and want to have ties there. Mm-hmm. What kind of ideas would you have for my getting clients there?
Well, first of all, I would say that you are certainly in the right field. Planned giving is the holy grail for every nonprofit. That's what they try to do. They start with friend raising when you're young. They get small donations, and then they want you to. The bottom line is, you know, that nice charitable remainder trust that gets, you know, that the individual puts in their will. Now, if I'm correct that Minneapolis area, there are a lot of like, isn't the Joyce Foundation based in Minneapolis, something like that? But there certainly are. I would be going to the foundation centers online or in person and find a list of all the nonprofits that are based in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I, you know, given that you have the best specialization in the world, Father Nemko gives you a total blessing that this is the right. I'm not telling you to change niches, just tell some success stories of how you turn somebody from a small donor into somebody who left six or seven figures in their will to the nonprofit. Tell those stories three or four times in a cover letter, in phone conversation, in interviews with the nonprofits that are Midwest centric, and I'm betting you get clients. Does that make sense?
Yeah, actually, my clients are the nonprofits themselves, and I get them to do what you're talking about.
Okay, well, fine. Same concept that you then talk about how you trained the what I call the pitchers at the at nonprofits here in the Bay Area or in Reno. You had clients there. Explain what you maybe even on this, even use video. What if you still do some training of folks on how to make the close in planned giving?
That and many other things. Yeah.
Right. So what I would do is next time you do, I imagine you do not yet have a video of you doing that kind of training. Is that correct?
Yeah, I like your Odesk idea. I just went there for the first time. I'm going to do the same thing.
This I would not use Odesk. I wouldn't, because you want somebody local to video you.
Okay.
So what I would do is, there's a million photography and film students, millions of them here in the Bay Area. They're crawling with them. I would go to one of the millions of art colleges that where the students are going to be in debt for over $100,000 a piece, and the students are desperate for work to make even a little money. I would go to the instructors of the video classes in, like, the Academy of Art School or the College, California College of Arts, or the San Francisco Art Institute. There's a million of them. And I would go to the I would phone or email the instructors of those and say, who would be a great one of your students? I'll pay him $100. Who would come and video me doing a training and edit it using, editing software down to the best 90 seconds and put some titles at the beginning and a music bed or whatever, and then who would do that? And that's what I would use, and I would send that along with the stories of my successes to those nonprofits in the Midwest. Does that make sense?
It does, and just one last quick question is that almost all of my 30s clients have been referrals. So that's, I think, my strongest.
You should always, it's the oldest rule in the world. Spencer Abraham, the old sales guy, said the best source of new business is your old business. Certainly ask all of your people if they can refer you to some places in the Midwest. I'm looking
Great.
At the clock. Show's over.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call.
Thanks so much.
That is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers and Paula Wilburn on drug abuse at work. Can you work effectively when high? And what to do if you may have a drug abuse problem? What if you're the boss or the coworker? That's on Work with Marty Nemko, Sunday at 11. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.